I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The New Statesman.
Hi, I'm Anoush.
I'm Freddie.
And I'm Zoe.
And this is The New Statesman's twice-weekly politics podcast. In this episode, we'll be discussing Boris Johnson's Partygate grilling and the latest on Brexit. Then you ask us about the government's asylum policies. For over 3 hours, the former Prime Minister Boris Johnson was questioned by the Cross-Party Privileges Committee of MPs about whether he intentionally misled Parliament over gatherings at Number 10 during lockdown. Freddie, you were actually at the hearing. Can you tell us a little bit about what the atmosphere was like?
Well, yeah, it was very hot. I think journalists were a bit tired. They were expecting what happened, basically Boris Johnson bumbling for 3 hours. And I don't think we learned much new, but the key thing was that this was Boris Johnson's chance to perform in front of MPs. This was his chance to say to the party, look, this Partygate thing, I've dealt with it now, it wasn't right, I didn't lie to Parliament, we can move on. And he didn't manage to do that. I think there was a general sense of exasperation in the room. Also, he got quite frustrated as well, and that was quite telling as well. He often got quite irritable when being asked the question. So I don't think it was great for him. I think we'll come on to the Brexit vote. I think that was absolutely pivotal to what he was trying to do yesterday. But yeah, it was a funny atmosphere. They put us, all the press sit behind the front table, so a perfect view of Boris Johnson's freshly trimmed hairline. Not great if you want to write. Not great for the sketch writers. I felt bad for them. But yeah, no, it was a strange one.
Yeah. And so you said we didn't really learn anything new. How do you think his reputation has been affected coming out of that hearing? Or do you think everyone just be thinking the same things that they always thought about him since these revelations came out?
Yeah, it's a low bar, isn't it? So I think he did come across in quite a mendacious way. He could clearly try and contort each answer to fit the question. Some of the things he was coming out with were just ridiculous. For instance, you know, I think Bernard Jenkin asked him, why didn't you have mitigations, as the guidance says you should do, on one of the parties? And he's like, well, we did. We had Perpex screens next door. And that's not, there's a different room. At one point he said, I saw the trestle tables in the garden, but I didn't see what was on the trestle tables. It was just full of ridiculous assertions to try and protect the notion that he didn't think at the time, and when he stood up in Parliament, that the guidance had been broken. So it led him to all these strange contortions and strange ways of him perceiving Downing Street. He spoke a lot about the narrow corridors. So I don't think it did anything very good for his reputation. We already know he's a performer, and that's what it was.
Yeah, he was equivocating a lot, wasn't he? Sort of wriggling around the questions. There was one part where he said that he couldn't remember whether he'd made a joke about this must be the least socially distanced event in Britain.
Yeah, it was. It descended into absurdity.
Yeah. And so what happens next? What comes out of this?
So we don't yet know what the committee are going to decide. It seemed to me, and it seems according to their most recent report, that they are going to find Boris Johnson has misled Parliament in some way. It depends whether it's fine, that's reckless, as they put it, or intentional. So that we expect that to be coming out in the next few weeks. And then the key thing is the punishment. Is it over a 10-day suspension from Parliament? If that's the case, then there's a chance that there's a by-election in his constituency in Uxbridge. If not, maybe he'll have to apologise to Parliament, so that'd be less humiliating, and maybe his career could be savable at that point. But if the committee do come out and say that he has intentionally misled Parliament, that's very bad for Boris Johnson and good in terms of protecting Rishi Sunak's, or getting rid of one of Rishi Sunak's main critics.
Yes, OK, because it could come down to Parliament voting on the punishment that the committee recommends. So that could be, I suppose that in a way, there's two readings of it, isn't there? That it could be good for Rishi Sunak if one of his sort of main rivals and irritants gets knocked out of the picture. But also it could bring the Tory party into division again. I mean, remember what happened when Owen Paterson, when what he'd done went to a vote in Parliament, it brought about the Tories' sort of long decline, I think, that we've been talking about ever since.
Yeah, that's when the polling starts to fall off. Yeah. I mean, the key thing with the Owen Paterson affair was that Boris Johnson whipped them to vote against the punishment. So Rishi Sunak and his ministers have basically said they're not going to do that in this circumstance. They're going to give him a free vote, and that should mean that they will vote through the punishment, but let's see.
Right. What stood out for you, Zoe, from Boris Johnson's performance? Obviously, as Freddie mentioned, this happened on the same day that Parliament was voting on the Stormont break, which is part of the Windsor framework, the deal that Rishi Sunak recently struck to create a new and improved Northern Ireland protocol.
So I think on Boris Johnson, one of the things that really stood out to me was the fact that one of his defences was these parties we had, they were necessary because people in Downing Street were really struggling. It was a really difficult time and we were working at these parties. And so what, there was a bit of cheese and wine, you know, that's how it's done. But this focus on necessity or how intrinsic that was to the working practices in Downing Street is irrelevant because the point of the inquiry is whether he willfully misled Parliament. Mm. So when looking into that particular element, the fact is it does seem that he did ignore advice from officials. So Martin Reynolds, his principal private secretary, told him not to say that guidance had been followed and the rules had been followed to the best of his knowledge. And Simon Case also said that he'd never told Johnson that the COVID rules had been followed. So right. I think, as Freddie said, it looks like they, if we're following the evidence as to whether he did willfully mislead Parliament, it looks like the committee will rule against him in some way. And this focus on necessity, we already know there was parties in Downing Street. Nobody, the people who think that was a fair enough excuse will still think it's a fair enough excuse, and the people who don't won't do. On the Brexit vote yesterday, obviously it was really interesting. It happened at the same time that Johnson was in committee, which was obviously going to split the attendance in the chamber and also the attendance of journalists covering it. Actually, I was quite surprised. I was in the chamber, or I was in the press gallery, at how few MPs were there. So there was a lot of build-up that this was could be a really big rebellion and it could unseat Sunak. Actually, it was the same old suspects. You had a few ERGers, you had Mark Francis, you had Redwood, and they stood up and they gave speeches. Their speeches weren't groundbreaking. Redwood was slapped down quite quickly. And then obviously you had the usual DUP interjections. Mm. But again, it wasn't, there was nothing there that people thought could really unseat Sunak. So we didn't have any interventions from key Tory rebels. So Ian Duncan-Smith, who came out and said he was going to vote against it, he didn't even show up to the chamber as far as I saw. I remember David Davies was there for a bit, but he just came in and walked out again. We didn't have these key interjections we thought we might have. And then eventually it actually went through. Sunak didn't have to rely on Labour votes. Obviously, there were some Tory rebels and some key ones. We had three former leaders, Truss, Johnson and Duncan-Smith. But actually, without key interjections, without key speeches, they look a bit quashed. Basically.
Yeah, it's not the same as the sort of Brexit wars of the Theresa May years. So those nail-biting votes and dramatic interventions, like you were saying.
Absolutely.
That was really missing, even though it looked a little bit like in the build-up that there might be a bit of difficulty for Sunak. I mean, the DUP had come out and said that they wouldn't vote for it, first of all. It was very conciliatory language, I thought, from Geoffrey Donaldson, despite what they were saying. Then the ERG were a little bit more punchy. They said the Stormont break is practically useless, and that suggested that there may be more of a rebellion than expected. But it seems like Sunak rode it out quite calmly.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things with the vote yesterday was it almost became about something else. If you go through the list of rebels, as Zoe says, then it was actually those who hate Rishi Sunak. It was less so about Brexit. It was about all those people who were either loyal to Boris Johnson or had another reason to disagree with the present government. And that was key because for Boris Johnson, he was going to leave the committee at about 20 minutes into his opening statement, go and vote, go and lodge his dissent with the government, come back, defend himself as the leader of this rebellion and bat off these pesky MPs who were trying to say that he misled Parliament. That didn't end up happening, in part because, as Zoe says, the rebellion wasn't as big as it needed to be. Because the key thing, if you want to look at leaders and leadership changes and whether Boris Johnson can come back or not, is the opinion of Tory MPs. They're the kingmakers in all of this. And if you don't have them on side, then you can't get back.
Yeah, and what I thought was really interesting is that this plan, this idea of him looking like he was on his way back and leading the rebels, backfired, didn't it? Because for me, watching, I wasn't in Parliament on the day, I was watching the sort of mainstream coverage of this, and it drew a very flattering contrast between the Conservatives' last but one leader, Boris Johnson, and Rishi Sunak's style of premiership. It showed that the sort of chaos and the incessant conversations about the parties from the Johnson years are a thing of the past now, yeah, and a bit of an embarrassment, and you're something to get over with. Whereas Sunak is moving things on by striking sort of deals that most of his party has got on board with and not drawing news attention to himself. We've actually seen very little of him, despite him doing quite a lot recently, not just to do with Brexit, but also the Silicon Valley Bank and other kind of trips abroad and things. We don't see a huge amount of him, but we also don't see very much chaos around the Downing Street operation.
Yeah, and that's why we've got Brexiteers in the government at the moment. Steve Baker has basically said to his ERG, or his former ERG friends, you need to get over this, you need to move on, this is a great deal, let's bank this advantage and move on. And that's Suella Braverman's in the cabinet. So he's co-opted quite a large part of the Brexit part of the Conservative Party into the government, which sort of quells that dissent.
And so it's turning out that the way that he cobbled his cabinet together at the start was actually in some ways quite wise.
I think it's really interesting that Steve Baker, Northern Ireland Minister, come out to be so supportive of this deal, and he's stayed really loyal and he's really proud of this deal as well. And it just, it does not only actually split the ERG, who I believe kicked him out of the WhatsApp group yesterday.
Those WhatsApp groups were once so important as well. It tells you so much more than Steve Baker's.
It also
standing.
Just looks to the public like the ERG have lost a bit of their momentum, really. It looks a bit like if they're divided, it undermines part of their plight, really. Mm. I think it was a wise move from Sunak to bring those ERG figures into his cabinet. And I think, as you said before, Anoush, about the DUP, although obviously they did vote against the deal, they did strike a conciliatory tone. They did say they'd continue working on this deal with the government. And I think, ultimately, the takeaway from yesterday's debate was there wasn't as much of that adversarial language around Brexit as we'd seen before. And ultimately, Sunak came out looking quite competent, really.
And we shouldn't let him off the hook too much, though, because Westminster can vote how it likes on these things. Mm. Ultimately, what matters is what happens in Stormont. And the DUP have not come back to the table. There's a few hopeful sort of murmurings that they might consider it after the local elections in May. I feel that's less likely. There's a lot of reasons why the DUP wouldn't want to go back into power sharing that have nothing to do with the Northern Ireland Protocol, even, that still exist. The idea of a Sinn Féin First Minister being an obvious one. And of course, I remember speaking to some EU sources before the Windsor framework was created, and there was this optimistic tone among them. The ERG aren't the force that they once were, like you were just saying, Zoe. But there wasn't much concentration on what happens in Northern Ireland. And I feel like this is, I mean, we've spoken about this on the podcast before, but this is always the way in which this is spoken about. Actually, that's probably more important than which Tory backbencher votes for the Windsor framework, because it affects a whole part of the United Kingdom. And we actually did have a question from a listener that we never managed to squeeze into You Ask Us about the real life impact of power sharing collapsing at Stormont. And I had a little look into it for this listener. And it effectively means civil servants can only operate within the context of the existing policy direction of the Northern Ireland ministers that set it before they left their posts. And you can't develop new policies or take decisions that might be considered political, which means that you can't do anything strategic. You can't do anything new. And a real life example of how this has impacted people, particularly on low incomes, is the delay in the rollout of the £400 energy payments that we got here, but not in Northern Ireland. And there's not been the necessary public service reform that you might need for an NHS that's in a dire state in Northern Ireland, although it is across the UK, it's particularly bad there. And also, they don't have select committees up and running in this period, which means there's a lack of scrutiny for the policies that are already being enacted by departments. So it does have a real life impact. And I think that Number 10 would be quite wise to be careful about seeming complacent about that issue.
Yeah, I think you're completely right. But politically, I don't think it's that important for Number 10. Most people, we had some polling that we did last year, I think it was Anoush, most people in Great Britain don't really care about Northern Ireland. And that's one of the reasons that we've not had Northern Ireland feature in the Brexit debate as much as it should have. It wasn't there in the 2016 referendum campaign. It's the reason that it's not featuring massively yesterday. It's the reason that many Tory MPs are able to go against what they said they were going to do with the DUP in the past few years. So I think in terms of government and, you know, the reality on the ground in Northern Ireland, you're completely right. And as we've spoken about it many times before, but the reason that Number 10 won't be too bothered about that is because people don't care.
Earlier this week, obviously, we saw a narrowing of the poll lead between Labour and Conservatives. And I know Ben Walker's written a really good piece on why that might be slightly, maybe not to read too much into that, but I do think it's interesting.
But do read
Ben's piece.
As always.
But it was interesting. I went to a briefing earlier in the week about the current kind of state of the local elections and the polling. And one of the things that was said was that Boris Johnson's impact, negative impact on Conservative Party polling seems to be wearing off. And I think it's really interesting that a lot of people talk about the impact it's had on the Tories, that there's been all this kind of infighting and instability and successive prime ministers. And I think what is good about the Brexit deal is that it does make the Tories look more united. And I think in turn that will build support for the Conservatives when they start to look like they're more coherent, more competent, more united. And so, as Freddie said, I do think there is something to be said for the political, although obviously very important that we consider the impact it's having on Northern Ireland. I think politically it's a strength for Sunak.
That's really interesting. This is probably part of another conversation for another time, but I interviewed the polling guru, John Curtis, in an interview that's about to come out. And he was saying that no government ever survives at the ballot box who's resided over a financial crash, and that you could count the mini budget and what happened and also the general state of the economy as a financial crash. There is no example that he could think of in this country of a party changing leader after that crash and the impact that the leadership change has on people's public opinion. And Rishi Sunak is seen as someone who is more economically competent than his predecessors. And if you say that briefing, the idea of the Tories looking more united, even if people don't care necessarily about the detail of the Windsor framework, might add to that presentational change.
After the break, we'll talk about asylum policy. If you're subscribed to The New Statesman, you can get all our episodes ad-free on the New Statesman app. You can get it on both iOS and Android. Just search for New Statesman on the App Store or Google Play Store. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
If you enjoy The New Statesman podcast, then you'll love our daily politics newsletter, Morning Call. It's a quick, essential guide to the big political story each morning by me, Freddie Hayward and Rachel Wearmouth, featuring original reporting from Westminster and beyond, our analysis of the latest political news, and some recommendations of the best reads of the day. Sign up for free at the link in the podcast description.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
Our question today is from Nikki. Is it possible, given the politics around the issue, to have a humane asylum / immigration policy / policies? So this is a really good question because we haven't managed to talk in great detail about the illegal migration bill that the Tories have introduced recently. And it does seem that this has had the effect that perhaps they wanted, which is making them look tough to the extent of looking cruel on asylum seekers in particular, riling up the sort of usual parts of the left, the liberal left, the campaign groups, the charities, and perhaps trying to fire up their base who are concerned about small boat crossings. First of all, should we see whether or not that's worked yet? I noticed that there was some polling recently that showed that still, I think, above 80% of the general public are unsatisfied with the government's dealing of immigration.
Yeah, I think the broader context is that immigration is rising in terms of people's priorities. There was an Ipsos index out this week or last week that basically said it's fourth now after inflation, the economy, the NHS, immigration. So it is becoming more important. And I think that's why Labour can't just sit back, rely on some urgent questions in the House of Commons and not engage with the issue. They say they've got a 5-point plan or a 6-point plan, but they don't talk about it too much. You're not seeing Yvette Cooper go out or write pieces for the Sundays or whatever it is and say, we have a solution as well. I don't think they want to talk about it too much because Labour normally has always cede ground on immigration because they think the Tories can always outflank them. In terms of the government, I think it's wise for Sunak politically to go hard on immigration. What Sunak needs to do is to convert lots of Leave voters. And at the moment, he's polling really well with Remain voters, less so with Leave voters. I think this is one of the key ways that he can bring some of those 2019 voters back on side. In terms of whether it works, that's a completely different thing. No, I don't think it will work. One of the key problems is that the government do not have return agreements with the country they need to send people back to. They've got some agreements in place. They've got some agreements with Albania, for instance. That's why Albanian immigration across the channel has gone down, because they're able to return them back to Albania. But they don't have them with Iraq, Syria, Eritrea, all these places. They're not going to get them. So that's why you've got the Rwanda policy, which isn't up and running. It's gummed up in the courts. And even then, there's doubts about the capacity of Rwanda to take lots of people in. So I don't think it's going to work. Maybe they'll say at the next election, give us another 5 years to implement this, especially if Labour don't want to talk about it. But they've not got much time to get it up and running before the next election.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, isn't it? Because what they've done is by focusing on this policy, by making small boats one of those priorities that Rishi Sunak announced at the beginning of the year, and with making such a song and dance about this illegal migration bill, pictures of Suella Braverman visiting Rwanda and looking really happy as if she's on holiday kind of thing. They've really brought it up the public agenda, haven't they? You're right. It's becoming one of those issues again that people are saying is one of their top issues. And I always think it's a danger for Labour and sort of groups that perhaps want a more... want a more compassionate asylum system to say, oh, well, immigration isn't a big concern at the moment. It can become a concern at any time. The government can make it so. Yeah, the papers, the broadcasters have to cover government announcements. And so if it becomes a priority for them, it does become an issue in voters' minds. Of course, you're right. The risk is that the more people focus on it, the more they notice that the government is actually failing on its aims at the moment. I think what's been quite clever, and this is what New Labour used to do as well, is the government are focusing on asylum seekers, so people crossing on boats illegally, in inverted commas, although actually this is irregular migration. You can actually, under the European Convention, you can actually come and seek asylum in countries. And that's one of the problems with this bill. That could be one of the sticking points of this bill. But what they're doing is they are taking attention off the fact that there is now record immigration, people coming into work here. And actually, in the budget, we spoke about this in the budget podcast episode, they didn't announce it in the speech in the Commons, Jeremy Hunt, but it was in the budget paper that they would be loosening the visa rules for construction workers, for example. So they're bringing people in to fill the jobs that we need done. But by looking tough on asylum seekers, they are trying to send a message to the electorate that they are wanting to bring down sort of net migration figures, even though these are two different groups of people. New Labour did the same thing. So I was looking at some of the language that New Labour ministers, Home Secretaries used to use. They would call people asylum cheats, people playing the system. Tony Blair used those words. People filing bogus asylum applications. And they also came up with some quite cruel and controversial policies towards asylum seekers. They were the ones that banned them from working, for example. They swapped their benefits at one point for vouchers to buy essentials. So they didn't have any money coming in that they could choose how to spend, which led to some refugees going hungry. And they barred children from asylum seekers from going to mainstream schools as well. So all of these were red meat to the tabloids, while, of course, they were bringing in a lot of migrants from Europe because of free movement. And so it looks like Rishi Sunak is using the same kind of strategy. What do you think, Zoe?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think with both of you, I think it's really interesting on kind of what you were saying about the Conservatives talking a lot about immigration, because it's a difficult thing for Labour to come back on, as we say. The Tories typically look a lot stronger on immigration than Labour. I also think having brought Suella Braverman into the Cabinet and making her the Home Secretary, that's been quite a shrewd move from Sunak, because he's brought one of the someone from the right of the party who's very strong on immigration and basically put them in charge of it. And so if it is to fail or any difficulties, it's laid at her door. Mm-hmm. And I think in that way, he kind of is slightly neutralising her a little bit, because it's like, if you care about this so much, then you can be in charge of it.
It's very much linked to her as an individual politician, that's true.
Absolutely, it's very much her brand. So I think it's quite shrewd politically. Again, the word is politically, what he's done there. I think the illegal immigration bill, we go back to the question, is it humane? There are so many elements in it that aren't humane. And I think essentially it isn't compliant with international law. And Britain typically have been accepting people genuinely fleeing persecution. So there are issues with that. I think, as you say, the Conservatives have gone very strong on this to detract attention away from the fact that we are relying quite heavily on migration to fill our vacancies. Labour has a kind of, Freddie, you mentioned their plan, 5 or 6 point, I don't know, I can't remember what it is, but part of Starmer's argument is we need to wean ourselves off this dependence on immigration. We need to fill these job vacancies ourselves, and we need an economy that kind of works on its own. And I think that's something that will resonate, but it does seem like a very ambitious and like long-term plan. So it's a very difficult space for Labour to prepare an answer that is adequate for the electorate.
Yeah, and our question was about a humane policy. And what's really interesting is that Labour, first of all, like you say, Starmer's sort of priority is to try and fill jobs jobs with British workers, which is which party leader has ever not said that, to be honest. They have quite, at the moment, they seem to have quite a similar policy to the Tories, really. The only way that they criticise the Rwanda scheme and also the illegal migration bill is by saying it won't work. They don't talk about the morality of it because they know that the votes are not in that. And but the problem is that when you say it won't work, you have to then say how you would do it instead, eventually. And I can't imagine anything that's going to be miles away from the system that we already have, which is looking at the shortage occupation list every few months and saying, OK, let's loosen the rules for this sector and then just bring them in.
We need more migrants.
Yeah.
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 I mean, yeah. Labour's key thing is that they're going for growth. That's what they said. That's the second or first mission, whichever one it is. And I can't imagine them jeopardising that goal by reducing immigration numbers. Maybe they do, but I don't think that's what they're going to do. But just on the humane policy point, the big problem at the moment is that asylum seekers aren't being processed through the system. That's why they're in the hotels. And it's worth pointing out that being in a hotel for an extended period of time is a horrible experience. It's awful for people's mental health and their health as well. That they're given, I think it's around £10 a week to live off. Yep. I was speaking to one charity worker when I was up in Glasgow looking at how they're housing Ukrainian refugees. And she was just saying that you can't expect people to spend months and months in hotels because they're not able to work, because asylum seekers don't have the right to work. They're not able to build a life or contribute in any way. So it leads to massive frustration. It's very unhealthy and it is inhumane to keep people in the hotels. I think that's the key point.
Yes, I was speaking to a lawyer representing some asylum seekers in one of these hotels. And they sent me some pictures that I haven't published because they're quite disturbing, but they're of the bed bugs, the bites from bed bugs. Obviously, the hotel doesn't care about the conditions that the people are living in because they're not paying guests. Like you say, it's not, I think there's a sort of sometimes a bit of a misunderstanding about what it means when asylum seekers are housed in hotels. They're not using the spa. Yeah. And this is one of the problems as well. If you live in an area where there are asylum seekers put up in hotels, you may think, how come they get free accommodation in my town and they don't work? There are all of these problems because it creates this perception that they're taking something, but they're not giving back into the system. Actually, they're not allowed.
They're not allowed to,
Exactly.
And the other thing is that all these hotels are mostly in deprived areas in the north of England. I think there's only one in the top 10 that host asylum seekers that is in the south. Maybe most people don't see them, but there are communities around the country that do see where people house in hotels. And that, for the migrants, for the hotel, for the community, that's not the optimal situation.
Yeah,
they
not
should
right
be processed.
For
the Home Office is struggling or is not able to process these people, judge whether they have a valid claim or not, and let them into the country or not, because they just don't have the infrastructure in place. And that's what's leading to much of the inhumanity at the moment.
Yeah. But it's worth saying there are a few little slivers of humanity, even in the Conservative offer. So they recently, we spoke about this on a previous podcast, so I won't go into the detail, but they recently announced basically what amounted to an amnesty for asylum seekers from certain countries, didn't they?
Yeah, but did they do that because they didn't have the ability to process them, or did they do that of altruism?
Not out of altruism, I think to basically clear that, try and clear that backlog quicker. But this was effectively people coming from countries where the likelihood of their asylum claim being approved is high. So it's just made it so that they can just fill in a form rather than have the face-to-face interviews. So there's that aspect of it. And then there is also a provision for a safe and legal route in the illegal migration bill, which is, you know, what a lot of charities have been calling for, a route whereby people can come legitimately in the sort of language that the Home Office uses so that they don't have to use small boats or hide in lorries or other ways. But the problem with that aspect of the legislation is that it will only come in after the small boats are stopped. So obviously, a lot of people working in this policy area see that as part of the way that you stop the small boats rather than something that comes afterwards. But it does exist in the legislation.
Yeah, yeah. Just going back to what you were saying about New Labour, Anisha, I remember your piece, it was a great piece, and you were just highlighting how governments treat different migrants in different ways. And I do think we have a broader hierarchy of refugees in the UK. We do have some schemes. We've got the Hong Kong scheme, the Afghanistan scheme, which has many fewer than the Hong Kong, and then the Ukrainian scheme. Now, those are the routes that the government has decided to let people through. I don't think there's enough discussion about why we choose these routes and choose these countries and not other routes. The Home Office, the government might say, okay, it's because we have a cultural or historic relationship with them. Hong Kong is a former British colony. Lots of Hong Kongers own BNO passports, a British national overseas passport, that is. And then obviously in Afghanistan, the army was in the country for 20 years. So I don't think there's enough discussion about that and why it is that we're letting so many people in from these countries and not others.
I suppose it's because of those ties, like you say, but also I think there is an element of public opinion playing a part in that. And you wrote about this very well in your piece about the Ukrainians housed on the cruise ship in Scotland, about the hierarchy of refugees. And even with Ukrainian refugees now, there are questions about what happens to them once these sort of schemes come. For example, the Homes for Ukraine scheme. Yeah. People can't keep Ukrainians housed in their own homes forever. And a lot of people have been talking to one of our data journalists, Polly Beinman, about their concern about what happens next. And she spoke to one lawyer who actually said that they might start applying for asylum because there's been no clarity on whether they're allowed to go into settled status after some of these schemes have played out. So even with the Ukrainians, where I think there was the weight of public opinion was on the side of allowing them to come to the UK, there are still questions about their future here.
Yeah, I think whenever you have, especially whenever you have a time where there's kind of economic unrest, we've seen throughout history that often a lot of the tension is directed towards these people. You talked about New Labour's language, scroungers or whatever, and that's directed at people in the UK often who don't work, but also often directed at asylum seekers and refugees and immigrants. And I think, yeah, I think we can obviously make a good case for refugees from Ukraine, etc., because that's part of our kind of consciousness. Of course, we're allies of Ukraine. But as Freddie said, what about all the other people who are fleeing war-torn countries? And wars have been going on for years and years. And we are effectively saying, yeah, we've got schemes for Ukrainians, but these people, we can only accept so many of you, or etc. So I think there is a real issue, which is that it's a historic and political one, which is that we always need a scapegoat, and certain people will avoid that, but certain people won't.
Yeah, and we are always going to have to choose, obviously, and create routes and create systems, and there's going to have to be some form of process. I think one of the interesting policy ideas that's come out of the past 6 weeks or so, the debate around the illegal migration bill, is if you equalise the system a little bit more, but then create a refugee cap or an asylum seeker cap that's decided in Parliament or what have you, and maybe that's one way to help deal with the situation.
I guess the only thing to say is that as we know, as we increasingly deal with war and environmental disasters and stuff, we're going to see more net migration across the world. And so to talk about the idea of having an asylum cap or a refugee cap, that almost feels possibly slightly like it could be considered eventually inhumane, because how can you put a kind of stop on the number of people who need a place of safety? So it's going to become a really tricky, especially as the years go on and we see more and more people needing to migrate for their safety. It's definitely going to become, I think, a much bigger issue, and it's going to bring with it some real moral, social and political questions about how we deal with this.
Thanks so much for listening. If you'd like to submit a question for us to discuss on a future podcast, you can do so at newstatesman.com/youaskus. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shekelian, and my colleagues Freddie Haywood and Zoe Grunewald. We'll be back on Monday. Follow us on your podcast app to make sure you get new episodes as soon as they're released. We're produced by Adrian Bradley.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.